are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 3rd, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Wednesday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Megan Day, staff writer for the Jacobin magazine. We will talk about Brett Kavanaugh, the banality of the work of the ruling class, debunking the meritocracy myth, and austerity through paperwork. With the ever-brilliant Megan Day, dozens of potential sources of information say they have not been contacted by the FBI in the Kavanaugh investigation. Dr. Blasey Ford, has demanded an interview in the FBI probe herself. And Donald Trump has finally gone all in on a grotesque and savage attack of Christine Blasey Ford.
I'm a counterpuncher.
That's what I do when I do a fascistic rally and attack a rape victim. Could this correlate with new revelations from the New York Times on essentially his allegations that his family's taxes are just a giant, basically criminal scheme? Or the prototype future of all Republican tax policy? Remember, he only got a small loan of $1 million. Even the lie that made him look privileged was a total lie.
And I paid it back.
Right.
Only time he's ever done that.
Right. My dad, you have to pay it back. It's your dad. And Michael Bloomberg has just given $20 million to Senate Democrats. Cash those checks. And what the hell? Feed those 2020 delusions. I don't care. Pentagon walks back a plan to withhold cash from defense contractors after pressure from lawmakers. That sounds about right. New moves in the House of Representatives to cut off funding from the United States for the mass murder in Yemen, conducted with the U.S., the U.K., Saudi, and the United Arab Emirates. Jair Bolsonaro, Brazilian fascist candidate, is surging in the polls as reports of extortion by bosses over workers doublespeak. On one hand, the business lobby is hearing that the Brazilian constitution will be rewritten to destroy unions, and workers on WhatsApps are getting messages saying, of course he's not anti-worker and anti-union. Classic fascist doublespeak.
We won't leave anybody in the streets for lack of health care.
Exactly. And a court deals a major blow to a controversial Appalachian pipeline, momentarily halting construction even as the Trump administration is moving forward with relaxing restrictions on radiation. We talked about mercury yesterday and a new tax package which will further decrease your wages is in the Congress. All that and much more on today's Majority Report. Sam, I think he's arrived. I was going to say, I'm going on a plane. I don't know if I'll be back again. But I think he's already in Vegas. He's already in Vegas at the... I was going to make a bra convention joke, but he's at the torts conference.
He's gone to his happy place.
I wonder if there's any mass torts revolving around bras.
Right. And don't you say that that's bad for their backs. Scandal.
Tell you what, Sam, I've been a lawyer for 25 years practicing.
Yeah, it would be something like Tennessee.
Yeah.
Who like just sounds like normal guy.
Yeah, we started up a practice down there in Macomb County.
We got into the document dump, and you couldn't believe what we saw.
You couldn't believe it. The woman's entire back was thrown out when the snap and her adjust back didn't work. Now, and I thought, okay, any fair-minded person would say maybe one's just a malfunction. Well, I'll tell you what, we found documents. 3,000 women,
Seriously, oh my God.
These bras just, these bras snap off at 200 miles an hour.
These bras will snap off at 2,000 miles an hour. That is the velocity of a, just for point of comparison here, that is the velocity of a Serena Williams serve.
So a velocity of a Serena Williams serve, and this is happening to women's backs across the country.
Well, exactly, Sam. I think you pretty much put the nail on the head right there.
I actually think that bit might have legs. Bra class action tort Sam interviews.
Or should we say clasp action?
Ooh.
Dad jokes.
Huh. Now, I don't know how we transition from that funny material. I have been a little bit surprised that Trump hasn't gone all in disgusting before on Christine Blasey Ford. But he did just that. He was at a rally yesterday in South Haven, Mississippi. Is that right? And here he is, viciously mocking Dr. Ford. And this is, you know, bear in mind, the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee who are pushing through the confirmation of Kavanaugh, who lied continuously, where I believe, as much as I can, I believe Dr. Ford, most people do, they're claiming that they believe her, but it's some type of confused memory or something. And as Eric Levitz pointed out, at this point, even if an FBI probe cleared Judge Kavanaugh of these charges, or, you know, even if he was cleared, he's clearly displayed that he has no judicial temperament and is a whiny hack reactionary who had a meltdown on national television and went on about, he literally talked about these charges in the context of a Clinton conspiracy theory. That's Newsmax editorial stuff, which again shows you that that's what the Republican Party is. It's all a Newsmax editorial. But they are in the contradictory position of feigning compassion and concern about these issues while pushing it through. Trump is going to go the full disgusting route by just attacking her and really expose them even more, because this is what they're doing. They just don't want to own it like Trump is doing. But this, what Trump is doing here, this is what the Republican Party is doing, even if they feign concern and respect.
What he's going through, 36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember. And a man's life is in tatters. A man's life is shattered. His wife is shattered. His daughters, who are beautiful, incredible young kids. They destroy people. They want to destroy people. These are really evil people.
That was what Lindsey Graham's thing was. And people should recognize that this is, again, this is the Republican Party message. Even if, and the Republican Party strategy and the Republican Party commitment, even if other members of the committee are simultaneously speaking out of both, or, well, they're speaking out of both sides of their mouths, and they're voting and they're muscling and they're moving politically in one way, which is to completely railroad this process because they don't care. And as with pretty much everything else with the Republican Party, from oligarchy to corruption to racism to xenophobia to misogyny, Trump is the one who speaks it clearly. So believe him, because he's the essence of this whole thing.
And this works on his base because, I mean, most people don't understand the psychology of trauma. And, you know, right. Blasey Ford explained it on the stand, but most people probably didn't get it. So when you hear him say that, like, it makes sense to people, to his people. Like, they're very ready to believe it.
There's a Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday about non-college educated white men. 65% support confirming Kavanaugh, 66% believe Kavanaugh over Ford. It's basically two-thirds of uneducated white, non-college educated white men believe Kavanaugh, and that's what Trump is playing to. And it is a terrifying number. I do sort of wonder if this would, if it would be like, you know, 80% if we were in like even the 90s, but I don't, who knows? Who knows what progress
and
is?
And it's not
90s
just men.
Might not even be a story. No.
Like the women who support Trump still support Trump.
White women, yep. Yeah.
They didn't care about grab them by the pussy, and they don't care about this.
Women were cheering just as much as the men in that.
Okay, folks. No elegant way of transitioning. Sam likes ads. Let Sam read you an ad, and then we will be returning with Megan Day, Jacobin Magazine.
Hey, folks, it's Sam here. And support for today's show comes from Brooklinen. Named the winner of the best online betting category by Good Housekeeping, Brooklinen is the fastest growing betting brand in the world with over 20,000 five-star reviews. And I will tell you this, one of them is mine. Their mission, to bring five-star hotel quality sheets to everyday life, offering luxury sheets without the luxury makeup. Their method, eliminating the middleman to keep things personal from design to manufacturing to custom service and beyond. Okay, I have, as you know, multiple sets of Brooklinen sheets. I don't want to get too detailed here, but the way that we do it with our separation is the parents switch back and forth. So I have them in my outside place. Wait, Jamie, are you making a face? Like, should I not be talking about this? Or is that something totally different? Okay. So I've got in two different locations sets of Brooklinen sheets, and I love them both. I finally get to choose the classic, I think they call it percane. I'm not sure what they call it, but it's the classic cooler cotton. And my daughter now has demanded a set of Brooklinen sheets for her as well, because she loves my sheets. They're so comfortable. And they look like I actually know what I'm doing when it comes to like something to do with style, which is, believe me, a huge uphill battle. My Brooklinen sheets are the best. They're the most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer for just my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so sure you're going to love your new sheets. They offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever.
Ever. I got to learn. I have to learn from the master right there. Casper, I like beds. Okay, everybody. We are going to be right back with Megan Day on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Megan Day. She is a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. Megan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, you wrote a great piece called The Banality of Brett Kavanaugh. I want to quote from it briefly. The Brett Kavanaugh hearing was a kaleidoscope of family and God and prestigious clerkships spliced with boofing, ralphing, and brewskis. It was a thorough dressing down. In the end, one was left with the impression of an unremarkable guy who was born on a conveyor belt to power, without much obligation to distinguish himself from his peers. On the contrary, his success was relatively guaranteed on the condition that he didn't distinguish himself from them, that he simply played nice with the fellas and not necessarily nice with women, from prep school to the Ivy League to the White House and beyond. So I think, I mean, you captured it, but break that down for us in terms of what you saw about how non-remarkable this guy was and what that says about how we conceive of elites in general.
Right. So I watched the Brett Kavanaugh hearing like everyone else. I was chatting with friends while watching it. I think everyone was just stunned at what we were seeing. I'd never seen anything like that. I don't typically tune in to congressional proceedings. I think they're usually pretty boring. This one was far from boring. And right. Afterward, I was, you know, I got a call from my editor and he was like, "So what do you have to say about this?" And I honestly couldn't think of anything to say. There's so much that made me angry. There was so much that boiled my blood, so much that seemed unfair, so much that seemed anti-democratic or counter-democratic about the whole process. And the thing that finally in that conversation with my editor really ended up rising to the top for me is that the way that Brett Kavanaugh responded to questions about his prior bad behavior, alleged bad behavior, by talking about how much he'd earned, essentially how much he'd earned the right to be on the Supreme Court because he'd gone to the very best schools and had the very best appointments and knew the very best people. You could hear it. It happened maybe 7 or 8 times that was how he responded to a specific question about his past behavior. And so that got me thinking a little bit about this guy as a sort of ambassador for meritocracy. Certainly not the only one. In fact, the vast majority of people who constitute our political elite all went to the same schools. They went to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Brett Kavanaugh is among them. But I also was thinking about the way that everyone watching this could sort of, the mask of power slips a little bit in this mm-hmm. moment. And you realize that this is just an ordinary, extremely grating, not particularly insightful dude who got, as I wrote in the piece, born on a conveyor belt to power. You know, he was sort of on the condition that he didn't, you know, that he moved with the pack and that he looked out for his buddies and, you know, and clung tight, stayed close, that he would more or less end up in a position of power, whether that was in politics or whether that was in real estate or finance or, as I mentioned later in the piece, military weapons manufacturing. You know, it could have been anything, but he was going to make it. And I think that right. the thing that that for us to realize in this moment, and the thing that I think many of my peers, because I'm 29, and I think that, you know, as I write in the piece, new generations have to be exposed to the collapse of the illusion of meritocracy over and over again. Meritocracy being, of course, rule by the most excellent. The idea that the people at the top have some sort of special innate excellence. This seemed like a moment when that really crumbled. Just watching this extremely unremarkable guy and wondering how in the hell he got there and starting to put the pieces together for yourself.
Right. And you talked about, I mean, you said, yeah, look, juvenile, sexist, emotionally reactive. And I think that's that specific point is really important. And it comes up again and again and again, this idea that people like that, he would have really needed to have radically gone out of his way to not be a success. And one of the things that, which of course then makes the whole idea of success or not success a much more muddy concept than we like to talk about it usually, right? Like if he would have needed to sort of bend over backwards to not be quote unquote successful, then what exactly does that mean? And in addition to that, you know, it struck me that obviously he lied. Well, I mean, in my view, obviously he lied quite a bit during the proceedings about things both, you know, large and incredibly serious and maybe things that are relatively trivial. One of the areas, though, that he got dinged on was they reported the day after when he said, you know, I got into Yale Law of my own merit. And of course, it was revealed, I think it was his grandfather was an alumni of Yale Law. And people went and, you know, it's a totally fair interpretation. There's another Brett Kavanaugh lie. Mine was, I don't think he's lying about that. I think in his self-conceptualization that isn't even an added bonus. He wouldn't have been there without his merits. Maybe grandpa went there, but that's totally incidental. So we're also, it's like we saw how non-remarkable they are, but we also saw an element of the psychosis of this particular type of elite in terms of how they conceive of themselves.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I think part of it has to do with exposure. People from this particular class stratum and the kind of insular world that people like Brett Kavanaugh inhabit their entire lives are not necessarily exposed to lots of people who work significantly harder than they have ever worked and don't end up, you know, on the Supreme Court deciding important matters for the entire nation. So I think that to some extent it's just like a matter of lack of exposure, but it's also the case that they're living in this fantasy as well. All of us are. It's not just that the people at the bottom, the rest of us, the 99%, whatever you want to call us, are living with the fantasy that the people at the top have some special wiring, some sort of like special hardwiring that's like actually superior to the rest of us, that gives them superior insight, they have superior talents, they work harder and so on and so forth. They actually believe this as well. It's sort of self-justifying. It's what keeps them going. And, you know, if I could speak a little bit on my own journey through meritocracy.
Please.
First of all, it's an important ideological component of capitalism because it is the justification for inequality in the United States. The idea that if you are at the top, it's because you worked hard and you had what it takes to get to the top. And that, of course, contains in it a secondary or corollary logic, which is that if you're at the bottom, it's because you didn't have what it takes or you didn't work hard enough to make it to the top. And anybody can make it from the bottom to the top. That is a rough description of what meritocracy is. As you can see, it obviously functions extraordinarily well. And it dovetails very well with capitalism. It's a sort of ideological mechanism of capitalism, if you will. For me personally, I think that despite, you know, being, you know, roughly a progressive or a left liberal for a long time, I think I had still a latent understanding that there was something superior about the people at the top for a long time, specifically until the 2016 election. And with the 2016 election was the moment when it was my big sort of emperor wears no clothes moment. In particular, I was extremely, increasingly frustrated by the fact that the Democratic Party frequently refused to stand firmly, consistently, full-throatedly on the side of working people. But I figured that there was probably some reason why that was the case, besides just like sheer thick-skulled inattention to the masses. You know, maybe the people in charge know how to win. They're in charge of battling Republicans because they know how to win. That's why they got that job. They got the job of a critical job of defeating the right because they're the people who are good at that sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we know they're good because they're in charge, right? See, do you see how meritocracy is a sort of tautology?
Right.
This completely fell apart for me during the 2016 election. I was like, these people do not know what the hell they're doing. And in fact, they're really screwing it up for all of us. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Every sort of all of the resistance of the Democratic Party to embracing the passion, the left energy of its own base, and instead trying to strike some sort of pose that was carefully calibrated to both siphon off a little bit of that progressive energy from the base, but also make the donors happy and also make the moderates happy and so on and so forth. It just was a recipe for disaster. Of course, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but you realize the Democratic Party lost control of both houses. And, you know, this is a decades long problem. We're now about to lose control of the Supreme Court, obviously. So for me, that voice, the little voice in my head that was always telling me the people at the top are there because they're better at solving these problems, it fell permanently quiet for me in 2016. It made it easier for me to see that something similar was happening in the Brett Kavanaugh hearing. I think that there are plenty of people watching that who assume that people on the Supreme Court, people who are nominated, get to the point where they're nominated to be on the Supreme Court, must have superior judgment. These are the highest judges in the land. In fact, what you see is that they're just at the top because they're at the top, because that is where they were born. That is, all of the structures were in place to float them to the top, specifically on wings of respectable pedigree and impressive social connections. And they don't have better judgments than you, and they don't have superior insights or talents. And here's the most important thing. They would absolutely hate for us to realize this, because they don't have irreplaceable qualities or insights that would oblige us to put up with their bullshit.
Right.
I mean, these people make decisions that devastate the lives of millions of people, and we give them a pass because we assume that they're best suited for the task. When we realize that they aren't necessarily, I think that inspires a lot of popular political confidence.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And actually, there was a piece, I think Eric Levitz wrote, about how John Roberts is actually, this is something he's been very worried about in terms of the branding of the Supreme Court, because under his, you know, under his leadership, this has already been, even with that, you know, quasi, I mean, Kennedy was, as you know, I mean, Kennedy was kind of a swing vote on important, but social issues, basically. He was not, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, when it came to corporate union and certainly voting and civil rights, not to mention, you know, corporate money influence in politics, he was a hard right vote with the other four. So, but Roberts, and part of the reason that Roberts, you know, voted against the repeal of Obamacare, although, you know, allowing states to opt out of the Medicaid expansion, which is obviously the most successful part of Obamacare, he's been really trying to cultivate, you know, while they quietly basically just implement a very extreme right ideological agenda with regards to voting rights and unions and so on through the court, he's wanted to kind of hold the brand of the court as still some type of noble, transcendent institution. And this definitely, I mean, you're talking about it in a much deeper and broader sense than just the court, really just the whole concept of the leadership class, meritocracy, and who we put on a pedestal and why. But that brand was shot by, you know, a red-faced guy talking about beer.
Mm-hmm. And how totally, it absolutely was. This is just another sort of, like I say in the piece that I wrote, this is another data point in the collapse of meritocracy, and the data points are clustering closer together. This is the court's time to experience a crisis of legitimacy caused by the crumbling illusion of meritocracy. But the important thing to note is that the court is far from alone. Right. And in fact, the greatest threat to this illusion in all American history is in the White House right now, Donald Trump.
Right.
It's not a coincidence that popular politics are gaining a new dynamism under his presidency. And that includes something we would consider positive, the swelling ranks of the socialist left, but also the, you know, flash of youthful alt-right energy on the right. You know, I think that the reason we're seeing that is because Trump is, like, as I write in the piece, a grenade tossed into the fortress of meritocracy. Like, Obama was so competent, and he just had this kind of Ivy League cool, right, and that actually kind of it wrapped it all up in a bow. This idea, you know, the idea that people got to the top because they were meant to be there, and where they are is proof of where they were always meant to be. They have a special gene that you don't have. Obama seemed like proof to many people that that was the case, and I would argue even for people who disagreed with his politics. But Trump completely blows a hole in that entire thing. He's transparently a jackass, pardon my French. He's an egregious bully, and worst of all, of course, he's unprofessional. And that right. just causes the and it's you know and it causes the entire house of cards to fall a little bit. You realize that there is not actually a pyramid that you ascend because, you know, you are the best, and the best of the best of the best get to the very top of the pyramid and get to be president. This guy is the worst of the worst. And I would argue even for people who agree with his politics and quite like him, that's actually what a lot of people find very attractive about him, is that they've already felt that the myth of meritocracy is wearing thin a little bit, and they have a kind of nihilistic death drive about it. Mm.
I think that's true. No, I'm just reflecting on that because I think it's always like, how do you tease out, like, what was the small, in my view, very, very small, but not insignificant group of people who are really desperate that were taken in by his con of populism? What's the vast majority of people who voted for him who are just Republicans, and Republicans are this far right white identity politics party, and Trump's the perfect candidate of that? But that's another interesting third equation. What's the element of people who are just like, fuck it? Like,
yeah,
I'll just
totally.
Burn this. Yeah,
I think there's a little bit of fuck it, especially in the first group, the people who have probably, I would say, in my experience talking to, and I wrote a book where prior to the 2016 election, I spent a lot of time interviewing working class white people in rural America, and found that there's a sort of like, this is not necessarily a negative thing. I think it can be a positive thing. There's a sort of incoherence to their political ideology. It's not as crystallized as it is for people with, you know, lots of educational opportunities, people on the coasts, mm-hmm. people who spend a lot of time in the discourse or whatever. People, these folks are a little more flexible, I would say. And there's a degree to which they're just, they know there's something sort of, rotten about the whole myth that they're being sold of meritocracy, because you know what the myth of meritocracy says about them is that
right.
they are worthless and right. that they are absolute failures, right? And there's a certain degree of an element of pride in blowing that to smithereens by rejecting the polished and professional candidate who comes from the world of the elites, the world of people who graduated with the best degrees from the best schools and know all the best people, and instead choosing someone who appears to be an outsider. Though, of course, the problem in the United States is that we have a lack of class consciousness, and so people don't realize that he is in fact an insider of the capitalist class. They see him as a political outsider, and I think that that's attractive to people who are extremely resentful about the effects of the myth of meritocracy on their own sense of self-worth, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And it's also very funny, too, to kind of even go with the campaign frame of like, you know, well, we might be able to rescue your kids because they might not suck as much as you do. Like, even that mm-hmm, is a kind mm-hmm. of extraordinary message, like, on those lines. Like, well, your kids should have opportunities. You obviously are worthless.
You
fucked it up. They might be able to get into a good college and be somewhat respectable, but obviously you're trash. I mean, and I think it's also interesting too, because Trump, it's like, right, the correct read and what isn't, because we, as you say, because we don't have class politics, is like, this guy's the ultimate, you know, trust fund baby, the ultimate product of, you know, unlimited access and privilege, and nobody with any different, you know, class, race, gender, background could live, I mean, literally could just live the life he did in terms of things handed to him for him to have the career he's had, let alone get away with everything that he's gotten away with, let alone walk into the presidency. And then conversely, what I do think people like about him is, I think it's like, he's also there is a certain small part of him in a really grotesque way that he is in on the joke. Like, I get it. Uh-huh. This is all nonsense. And if you kind of, there was that part of him that's like, see, isn't this all a con? And I'm like the ultimate con. And I'm sort of winking while I do it. And I think it kind of works. It works in both ways for that dynamic you're talking about, because it really exposes the whole thing, even in some ways, as you say, by him doing it, like, whatever, all these other people said all the right things, they did this and they did that. I just woke up and was ready to go on TV and have a rally, and Jeb Bush looks all low energy. Sorry.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think what's important to note is that Trump didn't cause what we're talking about, this collapse of meritocracy. Right. By the way, I'm not quite certain that this is the last gasp of meritocracy. I'm not saying that it's collapsing and we'll never see it again. I definitely think there's a crisis of legitimacy of the myth of meritocracy right now. Trump didn't cause it. The important thing, it was caused in large part, probably, it started to be caused in, I think in the 1970s with the turn toward neoliberalism. And I think that it was significantly accelerated by the 2008 financial crisis. But the problem is that the collapse of meritocracy tears a hole in the fabric of our national mythology. And there are a couple of different ways that somebody can ride in and take advantage of that crisis of legitimacy. You could have Bernie Sanders talking about how, screw this meritocracy stuff, screw this whole, learn to code. And if you don't learn to code, then go, die in some small town in the Midwest like you deserve.
That sounds like Peter Thiel's new book, actually. That would be a good,
right?
Yeah. Code or die.
You're like, go code or die.
Yeah.
So, and then Bernie Sanders says, screw code or die. We're gonna build an America that works for the people who create the wealth. Every last cent of wealth in this country is created by workers. It's not created by bosses. You create the wealth. The boss skims off the top. He takes it for himself. We're going to take it back from him. We're going to give it to ourselves, the people who created it, and we're going to have a better world for all. We can have it. It's possible. All it requires is the political will. That's one way to come in and take advantage of crumbling meritocracy, the sort of bipartisan neoliberal consensus whereby, people with the best degrees get to make all the paternalistic decisions for everybody else. The other way to take advantage of it is to be an absolute abject troll like Donald Trump and to ride in and say, isn't this fun? Let's blow it up. Let's blow the whole thing up.
Right.
And I unfortunately the latter is ascendant, but it might be a temporary. We don't know. I have some optimism. I think maybe this is, I think it's possible that this is the sort of immature, as a culture, we are immature in dealing with the collapse of meritocracy, but that collapse is a good thing. Right now we've made the wrong, we've started off on the wrong foot, but it's possible that we could see a progressive surge. We could see a left-wing surge. We could see, the rise of democratic socialism taking up a little bit of space in the vacuum that's created by the collapse of meritocracy.
Right. And the question, it's an evolve or devolve moment for sure.
Mm-hmm,
We have a few minutes left. I just want to touch on this because in some ways I think this fits in another way with the sort of the inverse of meritocracy and people who deserve to be terrorized, essentially. You have another piece called Austerity by Paperwork. We talked about this, not an example you used, I don't think, specifically, but last night on Michael Brooks' show, we talked about how 10 years into a program to forgive certain forms of student loans for people who did jobs in the public sector, different forms of like teaching or public contribution, they set up a program where you could, get discharged of your student loans. The first crop of people have applied for it that could apply for it, and they rejected, I believe, 99% of people's claims, right? And accepted literally 1%, which I think translated to, I think under 1,000 people. So this is a whole other arena. And one other example to put in, for all of his, Bill de Blasio is not, he's not the great helmsman of our future. But one really small but significant programmatic difference in New York City was, under de Blasio, there's a lot of investment in public awareness campaigns for what working and poor people have access to in terms of public programs. Under Bloomberg, there was never an ad on the subway for, you know, the type of SNAP program you might be eligible for, as an example. So there's this whole other set of people getting blocked from access and, you know, defunding things that actually haven't even been cut and are even still available simply through the sort of paperwork and framing of those programs. And this was a really good piece as well. So maybe you could just touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I took the opportunity to write this piece after reading about what happened in Arkansas, which is that, you know, the Trump administration has been encouraging states to implement work requirements for Medicaid recipients, never mind that the vast majority of people on Medicaid work, and that of the others who don't work, a plurality of them are either ill or disabled, or they perform unpaid but necessary care work in families where somebody else is the breadwinner. So they take care of children or elderly relatives because, of course, they can't pay for hospice care or nursing home, and they don't have universal child care, right? So these things are necessary. If they go to work, things are going to really, really fall apart. So Arkansas decided to take the bait, and they implemented these work requirements for Medicaid. And they said, you have to report, you know, this many times and tell us that you're working or that you're looking for a job, and then you can keep your benefits. And if you don't, then you don't get to keep your benefits. The problem was, it's not just that it's cruel on the face of it. For, like I said, there are lots of reasons why people who don't work don't work. And another reason, of course, is that there aren't always jobs to be found, especially if you have a criminal record. I think it's over 25% unemployment for people with criminal records. So mm-hmm. telling people, go find a job, it's not going to be given to you or else you lose your health care. I mean, this is extremely cruel. But it's also, there's another problem, which is that people did not know that the program was being implemented at all. And plenty of people who do work, actually, and are currently recipients of Medicaid in Arkansas, thousands of them just got booted off of Medicaid. And thousands more are coming simply because it's too complicated. They not only that, well, first of all, there was a lack of awareness about the program to begin with. And second of all, it's extremely complicated to figure out how to actually report. And, like, poor people don't have time for that. Right. You know what I mean? Like, people are busy trying to stay afloat, and they can't necessarily. And also, you know, like, apparently all of it is online. I just learned this after writing the piece. And rural people don't necessarily have access to computers or to dial up. And, you know, there are some, like, literacy questions and, you know, digital literacy and all this stuff. So anyway, this is the point of the piece, is to say that this is not an accident. The point of any more restrictive eligibility requirement of any kind on any social program, always and forever, is to thin the rolls. It's right. to kick people off, to make it less expensive. And when I say less expensive, there's a caveat there. Obviously, the costs are going to crop up somewhere else in society, whether that's because people now are experiencing substance abuse problems and they're on the streets and the cops are being called on them, you know, like whether it's that or something else, the costs come back. But this makes the programs themselves less expensive, which is always number one on the GOP's wish list. And the reason that it's number one on their wish list, aside from that they're gremlins, which they are, is that they are also engaged in a decades-long process of giving tax breaks to the wealthiest people in their state, to industry and to the richest, you know, 1% or 10%. And so they need to find that money somewhere in order to keep that program going without the ship capsizing. And a good example is that last month, I mean, literally just a couple of weeks ago, Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas revealed a plan to reduce the state's top marginal tax rate, giving away $144 million to the state's richest residents. I mean, that money's got to come from somewhere. Yep. Is it a coincidence that thousands and thousands of people are being kicked, who do, by the way, who do work for a living, are being kicked off the Medicaid rolls because they're not meeting their work requirements? I don't think that's a coincidence at all. So the point that I was trying to make is that complicated programs are actually one of the most clever instruments of austerity and of the right-wing economic agenda. And then, you know, if I could add on to that, which I didn't say in the piece, but which I firmly believe, the answer is universal programs. Not only do you not, when you said, you know, ads on the subway for what people are, you know, what people are eligible for, I think that's great. When you have complicated programs, you really need to get the word out.
Right.
But you could just not have complicated programs. You could just have universal programs.
Period.
We could just have single-payer health care, and then everybody has it, and everybody gets it no matter what.
Right.
That would solve that problem.
And then nobody has to waste any time with any of it, whether fiddling around with a website or subway ads or anything. We just have, you know, obvious reality. Somebody told me a story the other day of seeing a guy on the street. They weren't really paying attention. He was staggering a little bit. He was drunk, you know, probably a little drunk. He falls on a curb and basically just like smacks his face at a, you know, pretty hard on the ground. And, you know, they went up to him, they and one other person. And when he sort of came to, his primary response with like blood on his face was, "Do not call an ambulance for me."
Yeah.
Like that
yeah,
was his first
you hear
instinct.
This
yes.
a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. You hear these stories a lot. It's actually really heartbreaking, and it kind of drives home for you the reality of all of this austerity. I mean, we could be outraged when we look at the numbers, the $144 million given to the richest Arkansans, and then the, you know, and then the thousands and thousands of people kicked off the rolls. But the reality is that those are people who, when they experience medical emergencies, they're not going to want to have an ambulance called for them. They're going to risk death because the threat of medical debt or bankruptcy is too much for them to bear.
Absolutely. And you're right. Universal programs, democratic socialism. That's it. I mean, I wish socialism or barbarism was just like a fun thing to say to provoke people, but it's kind of stressfully true. So.
Yeah, that's right.
It is what it is. And we have a shot, as you say. Megan Day, staff writer for Jacobin Magazine. Really appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. Tomorrow, Sam joins us from Vegas, where he takes on the weird, wonderful world of torts. And actually, we always know. I mean, those conversations are actually pretty fascinating.
It was a tort week that I started here, actually.
I remember that. That was funny.
I remember it was the Teflon stuff.
The Teflon stuff,
there's
yeah.
There's a documentary coming out about that now.
Yeah. And then we would be sort of like, you know, talking off mic a bit, and then all of a sudden you just hear like, "Is anybody listening?"
No, that was the next time.
Oh, that was
first
the
time. I
forgot.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh,
this is before you, but it was.
I think it happens. I mean, it will happen over the next 2 days. Yeah, I mean, so it happens always. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I was on my best behavior the first time, but I feel
right.
The next
you were. That was extremely. That was a. Fascinating.
Guys, pay attention.
Guys, there are exploding sneakers.
Did you hear about these Remington rifles?
Did you hear about these? This is horror. The next time you were like, you know, I remember the first time I slowed down an Nixon tape. And then I thought, how do I speed this up? And then I was like, really? And then all of a sudden, I was like, yo, it's listening.
Hello? Truly a rite of passage.
Right. It is a rite of passage. The Vegas initiation. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. You can find links on YouTube and the podcast page to sign up. Pennies a day for a 5-day-a-week left show. Independent, unbossed left show. Like us on iTunes, write a review, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and you can follow all of us on Twitter, as well as at majority.fm on Twitter. Last night's Michael Brooks show, Daniel Bessner came by. He wrote this piece in the New York Times 2 weeks ago on a left foreign policy. We talked about why the concept of national security is fictitious, what left foreign policy actually means from a policymaking perspective. It was fascinating. Wealth and climate, gulag segment, amazing work by union organizers against, to try to persuade Joe Manchin to vote the right way. I don't think he is on Brett Kavanaugh, but they did incredible work. Plus, a very in-depth post-game, as always, this weekend, illicit history on the super elite with, in fact, Megan Day. And I just banked one with Milton Alamadi, one of our Africa analysts, on the history of the DRC Congo and the Great Lakes Civil War and how it relates to what makes your iPhone possible. Patreon.com/TMBS, Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Tons of new clips up, including about 20 minutes of Matt Taibbi and I on Thomas Friedman that just went up. And that was, in fact, very fun. Antifada, what's up?
So this week's Antifada is dropping tomorrow. We have artist, journalist, all-around awesome person, Molly Crabapple, talking about mutual aid in Puerto Rico and all of the different ways people have been resisting austerity there, both before and after Hurricane Maria. We also have unlocked our first in a series called History is a Weapon, where Sean explains historical materialism. So that's now free to listen to, whether or not you're a member. We also did a fun little bonus. You've heard of Real Tanky Hours. This one was a Real Maoist Hours. And we did a reading of this document. I don't know if it's real. Maybe it's real. Maybe it's not. The fact that I can't tell doesn't reflect that well on the modern Maoist movement. But we did a dramatic reading of this document called Towards a Protracted People's War in the Florida Everglades. It was supposedly leaked from a Maoist group in Florida.
Tomorrow's news today.
So that'll be out soon, too.
That actually sounds pretty fun.
I feel like
that is the type of thing that will be like a major use of resources by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security.
What, false flagging Maoist stuff?
No, seriously investigating that while they ignore white supremacy.
That'd be a good strategy. I mean, I thought about it from the PSYOP perspective, right? Like you infiltrate and do these fake Maoist groups to try to confuse the left. But from a left perspective, it might be useful to like make these fake groups that the FBI has to investigate. It's very confusing.
I know. Like I know that I always piss people off with like their little political projects. Or not always, but at times. But I'd say like Maoism in particular is a very like 1930s agrarian Chinese like land-based vanguardist communism for 2018 United States. Interesting.
They've updated it. Interesting mashup, guys. Florida of today. They got a snake economy.
I do like the music. I will give them that. Did you guys use this? You better use this for real. This is what we use for Maoist Bernie.
Oh, we should, Red sun we in should the add sky, it in. Yeah. No, because part of the plan
is... The sunflower seeds grows like the peasants will.
They're going to play music like this to propagandize and radicalize the Florida swamp people.
It's going to work.
It's going to work.
This is going to be at the Florida State Seminoles game.
Well, here's the thing. Like, they have like a grounding in history because there was a protracted people's war in the Florida. I don't know if it was in the Everglades, but the Seminoles and the Seminole Indians. Mm-hmm. This was a 7-year long Indian war.
That's what Drain the Swamp originally referred to, I think.
Jesus Christ.
I think that's right.
Really?
Yeah.
We should look this that
was,
up.
It was either that or slave catching. It had one of those two.
It was involved. It was associated with slave catching because they took in a lot of runaway slaves and actually intermarried and created a group of people called the Black Seminoles. And they were really badass. And this war lasted 7 years before the government finally defeated them. So there is a historical precedent for this.
Well, that's pre-Maoist, though.
Well, yes.
Don't attempt to colonize Native history with your fantasy-based Maoism, guys. But I look forward to hearing that. Matt, Literary Hangover.
Yeah, we zoomed past 1,000 subs on YouTube. Sweet. We're at 1,015 now, so I'm happy about that.
Nice.
Me and my friend Chris are going to record a bit on Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind. I've been going through that. One thing that reminded me of that we were talking about earlier is the way Trump's like, Brett Kavanaugh's life has been destroyed. His life has been destroyed.
Totally.
This is something conservatives do, focus on the individual, right? This is Edmund Burke talking about, isn't it horrible what happened to Marie Antoinette?
Mm-hmm.
And that is not what's important right now. Sure, it's bad that a family gets hurt, but as we'll see, like with the Sokolov sound, what's going on with ICE is destroying a lot more families in a lot more severe ways than what's happening to Kavanaugh's. What's important is the Supreme Court, and
right,
and like that's far more important than what happens to an individual's life. So anyway, that pattern has been there. The conservatives always want you feel. Wouldn't you feel bad if you were falsely accused after you were about as you were about to achieve a Supreme Court seat? That's how conservatives get the sort of populist victimhood thing, and it's gross. But so that's coming out this weekend, also for patrons, I am reading Hope Leslie, one of the early forgotten stories novels by a woman in America.
Sweet. All right, everybody. I am Zoran. See you in the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa. I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.